Okay. Now we turn to Cynthia Chung. She is a lecturer, writer, and co-founder and editor of the Rising Tide Foundation. She's going to talk about why anyone who professes to impose absolute limits to humanity's growth potential is either A, misinformed, or B, a liar. Hi, Cynthia. How are you doing?
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I actually have a lot to go over, and I have a PowerPoint, so I was thinking I'd just get straight into it, but then we'll have time for some dialogue afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Let's see. Can this maximize? Is this working fine?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, you can you see my slides on the side? Or
we see
okay.
It.
Okay, good.
No, it's all good.
Okay, great. So, yeah, this class is going to be. It's really a class because that's what I'm comfortable with. The end of limited resources, why zero-sum theory is false.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what this is going to be addressing is there's a lot of justification for the economic policy today based, you know, policies such as austerity, because we are told we live in a world that is governed essentially by the zero-sum theory. And that all systems that we see in the universe are closed entropic systems with limited resources. And thus, there's only so much to go around, and for one group to gain, another must lose. We've reached a point now where this is not only applied in economic strategy and warfare, pitting one nation against another, but we've also been told that we've reached a point where civilization itself has become an enemy to all life on Earth, and that our continued growth can only do harm at this point. Therefore, we must accept these austerity measures if we want to minimize our destructive existence, or else the Earth will be destroyed. So I want to showcase in this short presentation today why this theory, this understanding of the world we live in and the role we as humans have to play in it is not actually beholden to a zero-sum game mentality, but is in fact quite the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So much of what has formed the basis for this type of thinking, zero-sum thinking, comes from three related and overlapping schools of theory: the study of cybernetics, information theory, systems analysis, which predominantly emerged during and after World War II. Norbert Wiener, who founded cybernetics, is one spearhead of this, and John von Neumann, who founded game theory, is another. And it was sponsored primarily by the Macy Foundation, a very powerful foundation that sponsored eugenics in the United States during the 1930s. So quickly for the viewers, information theory in a nutshell is the theory of everything is controlled by feedback loops and information, and whoever controls the information controls the system. Cybernetics is the science of control of systems. It is the applied science to information theory. Systems analysis is a branch of information theory, the analysis of all systems, presuming they are, again, closed systems that will all wind down because there is a limited and ever decreasing amount of energy to make the system work. So systems analysis is used to analyze all systems in the world, from ecosystems to our economic system to even the galactic system. Systems, all are presumed to follow this law of entropy. This is what very much forms also the justification for why policies such as decarbonization and COVID lockdown response and economic policy are considered necessary as part of the Great Reset paradigm, with the explicit intention to bring a new system online that replaces nation states and democracies under a technocratic management that will abide by the so-called laws of systems analysis. It is argued that if we do not abide by this approach, we will bring upon ourselves our own destruction and possibly that of the Earth. So the question is this justified? Do we truly live in an entropic world and thus we need to move towards massive depopulation and drastically lower our living standard because we are consuming and wasting too much? So I think most of the audience is aware of Thomas Malthus, mm-hmm. who founded the Malthusian growth model. And the model puts forward that if population growth grows exponentially, but the food or other necessary resources grow linearly, it is inevitable that at some point in the future, we will hit a point of catastrophe where the human population will exceed its carrying capacity. However, the question is, what determines the carrying capacity? Thomas Malthus himself never actually specified an exact number for when the human population would hit its carrying capacity. This was because it was understood that the carrying capacity is not something fixed, but could be increased or decreased depending on our human-made innovations. Thomas Malthus did predict that we would hit our carrying capacity in 1890, about 100 years from the time he made the prediction. Needless to say, the historical accuracy for these types of predictions of when we would hit our carrying capacity have thus far been severely off the mark. And that's something really important for people to keep in mind, that there is no specific agreed upon point where the human population will meet its carrying capacity, since it's not just determined by the number of people we have on Earth, but also our ability to efficiently provide for those people, which can be increased with innovations. Innovations that can not only increase quantity of resources grown or created, for instance, but we have also made qualitative innovations, such as creating diversity in the biosphere. And, you know, one example of this is the basic foods we eat today were many of them created by man-made innovations such as corn, apple, watermelon, eggplant, banana, etc. Even livestock did not exist in the form they do today if it had not been for man-made innovations. And these go back for centuries, well before we knew anything about the genetic domain. So the ability to not only grow our own food, but to increase its efficiency in nutrition is a very important agricultural innovation that has allowed for the sustaining of more people on Earth, as an example. But we've done many of these types of qualitative changes. Another question people might ask is, are we running out of food at this point, or is there even a limited space for food production? And as we see with the above chart, the world food production is actually increasing. And the bottom chart shows that the amount of space required for food production is actually decreasing due to our efficiency in this. So in terms of the food supply, we are presently nowhere near hitting our carrying capacity, and the rate of food production is actually greater than the rate of human population growth. So what we are seeing presently is a lack of essential resources such as food and water in localized regions. There's not a shortage of food production occurring. We are and do have the capability of producing enough food for the entire world population. The reason why certain areas are suffering from critical shortages are mainly due to political and economic reasons, which I'll get a little bit into later on. Another just quick example to get people to think about our limited, you know, space on Earth. Right now, the world population is about 7.4 billion, and Texas is the size of 170 million acres. So in theory, you could house the entire population of Earth into Texas with one-level townhouses back-to-back. So that just gives you an idea of how much space we do have on Earth, not to say that we should live in that close to proximity, but there's plenty of space to go around still. In addition, we see, according to this NASA map, that the world is actually greener than it was 20 years ago, with the map showcasing the greatest increase in foliage as dark green. And we know that presently China and India have the highest population densities in the world right now. But what might be a surprise to a lot of people is that China and India are also leading the world in man-made greening. They've had a lot of success in sustaining this over the long term. And there have been healthy ecosystems that have been created through this process. It's very interesting to think, you know, the two populations that are the most overpopulated, sorry, that was a slip of my tongue, highest population densities also have the greenest regions. And one very good example of that is the Loess Plateau in China, where they've greened this desert through man-made process. So people might ask, but where would the water come from for greening the deserts? And this is just a poster from the recent Mad Max movie. It's very common for people to think of this post-apocalyptic vision that in the future we're destined to have water wars as the next resource war. And it is true that approximately two-thirds of the world right now is desert, although, as I showed in the previous slides, that's being decreased with the man-made greening. And the Sahara currently makes up 9.2 million square kilometers of the total 16 million square kilometers of desert in the world. And it turns out planting green stuff is an excellent way to reduce global temperatures and for temperature control so that there are less extreme fluctuations in climate. So not only do greening deserts obviously offer more food production for people, and it's going to retain the water in those areas, but it's been observed that it does stabilize weather phenomena. So for instance, because the Sahara is so desertified right now, the hot air that goes over the Sahara Desert quickly cools when it passes over the ocean, such that that is much of the reason why a lot of hurricanes tend to hit New Orleans and this vicinity is because of this drastic change in temperature. So not only is two-thirds of the world desert right now, but the grassland regions in areas such as Africa are presently experiencing desertification and is a major cause, again, in water and food shortages in these localized regions, let alone the fact that there is a lack of access to clean water in these areas. And I'm going to go through some solutions to this, but there are others as well, like the Transaqua Canal. I won't be mentioning in my slides, but that's also another great project. But here we see some pictures from Ellen Salvery, who has basically reintroduced a very old technique of proper herd grazing. Because presently the way that herd grazing is being managed, it strips the land of its vegetation and soil richness. But returning to the centuries-old approach to herd grazing, which, you know, people can refer to Ellen Salvery's TED Talk for the details of it, it can actually be a great benefit to enriching the soil and promoting vegetational growth. So here we see a slide to the left. They're both places in Zimbabwe, actually neighboring places on the same day. And the side to the right is an area managed by Ellen Salvery's herd grazing technique, whereas the left is managed by the old technique. Here's a few other examples. This is in Arizona, again, two different regions using Ellen Salvery's technique in Arizona. And this is the same region over time using his technique. So that's one way we can very quickly address desertification in poor areas like Africa, because it's basically just changing how you manage things. It's very cost effective and efficient. Another exciting prospect for the future is weather control through the controlled ionization of river systems in the sky. Atmospheric ionization systems have been successfully used to increase precipitation and affect associated weather processes. This has been done in multiple locations around the world, cumulatively for three decades. With further development of these technologies, droughts around the world could be overcome in a completely new and cost-effective way by the management of the water resources in the sky. Here are a few studies that have been done, which show that periods of low solar activity and high galactic influence, such as cosmic rays, affect the amount of rainfall and the amount of glaciation formation we have observed on Earth over thousands of years. So when we are It's theorized that when we are in different galactic environments, we see changes in our climate system. We also experience temperature change depending on whether we are moving above or below the galactic plane, as you see with the picture above. Thus, through observations and many studies, we are finding that galactic processes dictate how climate and weather are expressed on Earth. A study by Perez and Peretz have found that modulation of fluxes of galactic cosmic rays could also be the cause of Earth's periods of ice ages, and that it could be connected with a movement of our solar system within the arms of our spiral galaxy, as depicted in the below picture. They hypothesize that when the solar system is inside the arms, there's more dust, so there is less flux of the galactic cosmic rays. And in between the arms, we have the larger fluxes of galactic cosmic rays. And these periods coincide temporally with periods of an increased and decreased temperature of our planet. According to Sergei Polonets, who has over 35 years experience in space plasma physics and currently works at the Russian Space Research Institute, clouds which cover our planet to a great extent are formed due to galactic cosmic rays which produce ionization. And these ions then become the centers of water vapor condensation and nucleation and formation of drops and clouds, which we see every day. And there is a correlation between the cloud coverage of our planet and the variations of the fluxes of cosmic rays. This has also been confirmed by numerous studies, most notably that of Henrik Svensmark, who had found that there was a 95% correlation between cosmic ray intensity and cloud formation from decades of observations. So Sergei Polonets, he ended up doing work for a Mexican company named ILAT, which made experiments that stimulated rainfall. And they had contracts with the governments of different states, especially in drought areas of Mexico, such as the Sonora Desert, to produce rain to increase the harvest in these areas. This idea was first proposed by Russian scientist Lev Polmenik, who is the founder of the ILAT company. They produced rainfall by using an iron mast, as you see to the right, that is connected by thin wires to peripheral towers. If, for example, you put positive potential on this installation, the positive ions will be moved by the electric field up to the upper layers, and moving to the upper layers, they gain more and more water molecules and become nuclei to form clouds, as you see at the top with the ions. So if you put this installation near the seashore, as Sergei Polonets has done, you can collect the humidity and then transport it inland using the different potentials between the iron mass of one positive, one negative, one positive, and so forth. And this creates movement of the air, which is filled by these nuclei to form clouds inland. Polonets has had impressive results using this process and was able to fill up three dams in Mexico using this technology after 1.5 years. They were even able to fight off forest fires in the Yucatan Peninsula, creating artificial rain using this technology, which yielded about 20 to 30% increase in precipitation. So what we're finding, and I find that a lot of different fields are getting into this understanding of how our world is really situated in a much bigger world than we were, you know, accounting for a very long time. And it shows that we live in a constant electric field, which exists between the ionosphere and the ground. And this potential difference between the ionosphere and the ground, which is the source of much weather formation, including formation in thunderstorms, as well as other phenomena, such as this picture, which looks like something out of a sci-fi movie, but is in fact a rather natural occurrence. The phenomenon is called sprites or red sprites, which are large-scale electric discharges that occur high above thunderstorm clouds, giving rise to a quite varied range of visual shapes. They are usually triggered by the discharges of positive lightning between an underlying thundercloud and the ground. Thus, Polonets makes the point their ionization technology uses everything that is given to us by nature. helping a little bit with this ionization process to create additional centers of nucleation. So we have found through these studies that the sun, as well as high energy radiation, such as galactic cosmic rays, are actually a constant input shaping the environment of our Earth's atmosphere, affecting climate, weather, and how water moves through the water cycle. That is both the sun and galactic cosmic rays are the only known sources of ionization we have. They are also the source of the northern lights, where oxygen and nitrogen particles are excited, which cause us to see the green and red lines of the polar lights. So I find, you know, this is also a very cost-effective approach we could have to greening deserts, and likely in the future, this will be one of the cheapest ways that we can green deserts. And we can start today pretty much. There's nothing holding that process back. Another really good form of technology we have are CO2 generators, because it shouldn't be a mystery or a surprise to anyone that plants like CO2. And thus it allows for a much, much greater yield of vegetation in greenhouses. So this not only shows a lot of promise for areas of the world where it might be harder to produce those yields with the natural climate, but it also has a lot of applications for space travel. They can pump up to 1500 parts per million of CO2, and the average CO2 in the Earth's atmosphere is 400 parts per million. Applications to inhabitable regions such as Antarctica, or space such as Moon or the Mars. So these are just a few ideas that could, but there are many more that could facilitate a greater abundance in the necessities for life, but also have the capability to regulate extreme weather formation, increase biodiversity. So it seems that there's a lot of positive that could be contributed if such approaches were adopted. And all of these named, they can pretty much be adopted today. So the question is, why aren't they? Where did the domineering concept of limits to growth that still penetrates the consciousness of present day policies come from? So in 1968, the Club of Rome, a think tank of an elite membership, was founded to address the problems of mankind. And it was concluded in their extremely influential book titled The Limits to Growth, which was first published in 1972, that such problems could not be solved on their own, and that these problems were all interrelated. It should also be noted that the Club of Rome was involved at nearly the inception of the World Economic Forum. Pretty much, I think, the second year, maybe even like within the first year. And it was clear that the conclusions founded by the Club of Rome were meant to dictate policy amongst the global elite through the World Economic Forum venue. In a rather timely or perhaps conveniently, 1 year after the publication of The Limits to Growth in 1973, Australia's largest computer made shockwaves predicting the future trends such as pollution levels, population growth, availability of natural resources, and quality of life on Earth. It was ABC's This Day Tonight, which aired the story November 9th, 1973. People can check it out on YouTube for themselves. And this supercomputer apparently predicted when the end of civilization would occur, depending on the parameters it was given. So it wasn't just one prophecy that it was spewing. The year as to when civilization would end, which changed based off of the parameters, but one thing was always consistent. The supercomputer predicted in every scenario that civilization was headed towards its doom. So here are some scenarios of this, what this supercomputer in 1973 was predicting. And in the first scenario, which is the standard, resources are depleted to such a point that it causes the plummet of food production and industrial growth, and thus population growth will continue to a point where it becomes unsustainable, and then it will collapse with nothing to fall back on. In the second scenario to the right, with double the resources, so these are all theoretical, these are all hypothetical, right? They're just fooling around with the parameters. Pollution would increase to such a point that it would eventually lead to the death of the human population. Mm-hmm. In the third scenario, with unlimited resources and pollution controls, there would be still a shortage of food, unable to sustain the growing human population. And in the fourth scenario to the right, with unlimited resources, pollution controls, increased food production, and perfect birth control, it appears that industrial growth has still caused an increase in pollution despite the pollution controls, which in turn caused food production levels to drop, which causes the human population to collapse. So in every scenario, it appeared that, you know, civilization was inevitably going to head to its doom. And the moral of the lesson was we're supposed to learn was that if we do not curb our industrial growth, no matter what sort of controls or increase in resources we gain, we will be headed for a collapse point in the somewhat near future. So have these predictions by the supercomputer been accurate so far? Because, you know, these predictions were made about 50 years ago now. One really good example to give us an idea of this, the accuracy of the supercomputer is its prediction of chromium availability. So if we look to the chart on the left, which was its prediction, we see that the reserves of chromium will decrease as usage rates increase, such that approximately 50 years into the future, which is pretty much our time now, we should see a spike in actual cost of chromium. This spike in cost will decrease usage rates until no one can any longer afford to pay for the cost of chromium as its reserve levels reach a low. However, if we look at the chart to the right, which has been updated to what has actually occurred up to present day, we see that the reserves of chromium were decreasing until about the mid-1970s, but then increased drastically to a much higher level. This in turn has affected the usage rates of chromium such that they are so high today, they cannot be shown on the graph and are about 2.5 charts higher than what we see here. So suffice to say, this supercomputer prediction of future trends for just one resource, that is chromium, was way, way off. So the highly problematic chromium prediction made by the supercomputer, I think, is a very good indication of why these predictions are not and will not be accurate for anything that occurs in the future. The reason for this being that they cannot account for any sort of change. Most importantly, qualitative change, especially qualitative change that occurs via the innovations of humankind. And I don't think we should be naive either that such predictions of the doom of civilization also have a policy outlook that is situated in the realm of politics. And in 1991, the Club of Rome co-founder Alexander King stated in the first global revolution, which was an assessment of the first 30 years of the Club of Rome, he said, "In search for a common enemy against whom we can unite, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. In their totality and their interactions, these phenomena do not constitute a common threat which must be confronted by everyone together." Sorry, do constitute. But in designating these dangers as the enemy, we fall into the trap which we have already warned readers about, namely mistaking symptoms for causes. All these dangers are caused by human intervention in natural processes, and it is only through changed attitudes and behavior that they can be overcome. The real enemy then is humanity itself. So this is the moral of the lesson that is being clearly enforced today, that the real enemy is humanity itself. We are told to see ourselves only as akin to a virus which consumes its host, the earth. But What if our character does not lie in such a view? What if our character is actually more akin to that of a builder, a creator? Everything that lives on this earth consumes, but as we appreciate in any ecosystem, it also gives in return for what it takes. Is it possible that humans have a natural role to play in this? And so we're going to look at some qualitative changes that we are presently experiencing that is going to continue to challenge the playing field that this supercomputer thought it was operating in. And this is namely now in the realm of energy and what will energy be in the future. So as we see in this chart here, this is data from 2015, so it's going to be slightly off, but primarily it's going to be accurate for the most part, that as we can see, most of the world is below the Organization for Economic Cooperation's average 900 watts per person. And it is calculated that you would need one nuclear reactor every 3 days to be built for the next 30 years for by all of these countries, right? Not each country, but all of this whole area of this graph here would in total have to produce one nuclear reactor every 3 days for 30 years to catch up to the people who live above or at the 900 watt per person level. And as we can see with this chart, it is very clear that the standard of living is connected to the energy, access to energy that a country has. So what are, you know, some things that we have available actually today is nuclear power. Nuclear power is the greatest source of energy density we presently have, nuclear fission. And here is a picture of a Rising Tide Foundation colleague of mine, Cuauhtemoc Real Hernandez, who's holding a lead pellet that is equivalent in size to 300 grams of uranium, just to give us an idea of how big that would be. And this one little pellet has the capability to power the energy needs of one person living in a first world country for 80 years. The price of this pellet of uranium is $60 per kilogram. Quickly, I've gone more into detail about nuclear power, and I know that some people are concerned about the safety or the waste and all of that. And I've done another class that goes into detail with that. That's called "What Determines a Limited Resource," or "What Determines Limits to Growth." But I'll quickly go over a few aspects here. Current nuclear power plants are powered by uranium pellets, which remain in the reactor for about 18 months. After that time, the entire pellet is processed as nuclear waste, even if only less than 5% of the uranium is originally contained was converted to energy. So a system composed of breeder reactors, normal reactors, reprocessing plants would have the capability to convert 100% of the uranium to energy, thus reducing the amount of waste by at least 20 times. Most importantly, the type of waste is also very different. The waste of current reactors is problematic, mainly because it contains transuranics, which are transmuted into bigger atoms instead of fissioning. And these stay radioactive for thousands of years and have to be disposed in deep geological repositories, which are engineered to be perfectly safe, according to my colleague Quao, who's the nuclear engineer, and still causes people to feel worried. The system with breeder reactions, usually referred to as closing the fuel cycle, would only produce fission products, so they wouldn't produce transuranics. So far from waste, fission products actually have a lot of uses, especially in medicine. So they're not really waste products. We have uses for them. And it is also worthwhile mentioning that breeder reactors are far from a futuristic technology. The United States, France, Russia, and Japan have all built breeder reactors in the past, and they've all worked successfully. It appears the decrease in their number is more a political issue. Russia is now building a lead-cooled breeder reactor with the intended purpose to close the fuel cycle. So again, this is just some applications in medicine and other applications for the fission products that would come out of such a process. And I'll say a few words just on also the nature of radiation, because nuclear energy is really, really important for our future. And I think that it's good if people have a basic understanding of what even what is a safe amount of radiation, for instance, or how is our world naturally have radioactive levels, so that people realize that this is actually not as dangerous as some of the hype has made it out to be. So these are Geiger meters measuring background radiation levels in Los Angeles, New York, and Tokyo. It's from the documentary Pandora's Promise. So you see in Los Angeles, it's 0.09, New York, it's 0.12, Tokyo's 0.14. And of course, millisieverts, and most people are not going to know, you know, what that means. Obviously, we assume it must be safe because it's in those cities. And recall that when we receive the rays of the sun, as well as cosmic rays from our solar system and galaxy and likely beyond, this shapes the radioactive environment that surrounds our Earth and also is within our Earth. So interesting things to take note of. And again, this is the same person, the same Geiger meter. To the picture to the top left is a 2.13 millisieverts over the Pacific Ocean. To the right, New Hampshire, 0.30 millisieverts on a mountain. And in on a Brazilian beach to the bottom left is a 30.99 millisieverts. So one of the things we see is that radiation increases with elevation, which again makes sense if our cosmic rays are coming from the sun and galactic processes. But another thing we see is that radiation can be very high at certain beaches and also in hot springs. And interestingly, these beaches and these hot springs are known for their healing effects. So, this already challenges our understanding of how does radiation actually work in beneficial ways to ourselves, but also is actually a necessary thing for all life on Earth and even the formation of the electromagnetic field around the Earth and so forth that protects us and has a certain kind of environment that it keeps contained within. So looking at this picture, these pictures here, we see a village by Chernobyl to the top left, Chernobyl at the bottom left. So it's 0.91 at the village, 3.61 or 7 at the by the Chernobyl plant, and the Fukushima to the top right is 0.18, and by one of the radioactive waste containers, it's 0.70 millisieverts. So if we didn't have any way of understanding or comparing millisieverts, if you went from, like, for instance, the Tokyo number of like 0.14 or whatever millisieverts, and you saw Chernobyl's 3.67, you would think that could be very dangerous. But then we see at a Brazilian beach, it's a 30.99. So, and other elevations also can, or other areas of the world are also much higher than that. So again, it forces us to reassess how are we thinking about radiation in our world and how we actually have a necessity for it. Banana is another example. It's one of the more radioactive foods. And this is just a fun chart to give us a way of measuring microsieverts in bananas. And as you see in the bottom right, 5 million millisieverts is considered a lethal radiation dose, which is equivalent to 50 million bananas. So you can imagine if you heard in the news that a ship containing radioactive material of 5 million millisieverts sunk, that there would be a lot of craze over this, even maybe cities evacuated. But then if you were told that there was 50 million bananas that had sunk, you know, people I don't think would be too concerned for their safety. Again, another fun chart, just going mm-hmm. over our exposure with bananas. And this is just a quick chart that shows the safety of nuclear energy. It's one of the safest and cleanest sources of energy. Even our world in data acknowledges this. Actually, you know, it's acknowledged that that is the case. So here's another source who also shows that nuclear is quite safe. The question is then, why don't we, if the social progress index is undoubtedly linked to energy production of a country and nuclear fission is safe and clean, why is there suppression of nuclear power when it has the capability of massively increasing the standard of living of throughout the world? Well, as in a lot of things with big ideas, there is the matter of politics. And if the politics such as that coming out of the Club of Rome and the World Economic Forum have decided that industrial growth is not a good thing, well, that means that nuclear power is also not a good thing. And just quickly to say that the reason why we haven't had nuclear fusion yet is because the funding is really not there. And this was something that was already calculated in 1976, that if the funding were below a certain level, which we clearly are, as you can see in the with the black line here, that it would be a fusion never level. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we can say like, well, we haven't had the money to put into this. Here's a chart that shows how much money we've been putting into renewables. And so you can clearly see that the money is there. And considering what Europe is presently going through with its energy crisis, I would put forward that only investing in solar and wind is not a stable provider of energy for the people. Just like a farm doesn't grow one type of crop, energy forms that are highly affected by weather are not a reliable primary source of energy for large populations. Thus, the reason why nuclear has not become the leading energy source is a political reason. The reason why we have energy shortages presently in localized regions is a political reason. It is not due to scarcity of resources. We will not even be close to reaching any limits in the next 100 years. However, it is a valid question to ask, what does our long-term future look like on Earth if we transfer over to fusion nuclear power? Will there be a point where we do hit our carrying capacity? So I just have a few more slides and I'll be done. One game changer to this idea of limited resources is the very exciting prospect with nuclear fusion, that of the plasma torch, which has the capability of turning landfills into resource mines. So the plasma torch is something we already have. It is going to be the future in industry if we apply it, which will completely revolutionize our relationship to resource and waste located in low and high temperature plasma processes, which will dramatically increase the productivity of steel, iron, titanium, and any other metal resources needed for modern society. The plasma torch functions by injecting gas into the chamber, the electric discharge traveling from the negatively charged cathode to the positively charged anode heats up with the resistance from the gas to such a high temperature that ionization occurs, and you can reduce any material to its elemental components. Here's just a picture of how a fusion torch would act. So this would allow, a fusion torch would allow for more advanced materials than we currently can produce, which are presently impossible to create with the lower energy yield technology we presently have. So with the plasma torch technology, pure elements can either be safely released into their environment, as in the case of nitrogen or oxygen, or they can be totally recycled as in industrial raw materials, such that there is absolutely no pollution. So the plasma torch technology exists today. It's been commercialized for decades, but it has not been in widespread use due to its large need of electricity, which makes it currently very expensive. Only military bases and specialized industries use it presently. However, with fusion technology, electricity for nations will become the cheapest it has ever been, making it economically viable for all industrial waste, industrial pollution, landfills, garbage islands in the ocean to be recycled into resources that can be used once again for commercial and industrial needs. So suffice to say, the plasma torch technology will not only get rid of landfills in a clean and sustainable manner, but it also means that there will be no such thing as waste anymore, since everything we use can be used over and over again, such that a resource has no end. Even the material of old, out-of-date infrastructure can now be reused once broken down to its elemental components to supply material for new infrastructure, and wood burning and fossil fuels will no longer be needed. So to wrap it up, water canals, nuclear plants, and high-speed rail all need a lot of steel, much higher than what is our current capacity to produce worldwide. In a fusion economy, there will be no longer such a thing as limited resources. There will be no zero-sum artificial restrictions. There will be enough not only to support a growing population on Earth, but to support populations in the future that will inhabit the surface of the moon and Mars, possibly. Fusion will also produce the rockets we need to travel back and forth to Mars in a timely fashion. Thus, in a fusion economy, the future will look towards the existence of yet to be created potential. And the greatest good for the greatest possible number will become a reality. Resource wars and economic competition over limited resources will no longer be, and cooperation towards universally beneficial projects, not only cross-continental, but interplanetary, will become the new norm. And that's it. Sorry for going through so much information, but I thought I would take advantage of the platform.
Can you send us the entire presentation so that our viewers can follow up on this?
Sure.
That's great. I do, in the meantime, I have come to the conclusion that we're going to have to reevaluate pretty much everything. We have to be aware that much of what we think is just an illusion. Much of what we think is reality is an illusion. I used to see the role of the Club of Rome completely different from what I see now. They do seem to serve the globalistic agenda of global corporations and global NGOs. But we know in order to really understand what you just told us, we have to take a closer look at these things. Because, you know, everyone used to believe, at least in Germany, that nuclear energy is really dangerous. That may have something to do with the fact that nuclear energy was really a side product of people trying to make nuclear bombs. That's what made it so dangerous. But there are other approaches, obviously. Mm-hmm. And so if this turns out to be a viable, and it does look, at first glance, it does look very convincing, a viable alternative, then why not? Because as you showed us in that chart, it is the safest source of energy of all.
I think that, you know, as we become more mature, we in our ability to create things that are more complex and grandiose, there's always going to be, with anything that we introduce as an innovation, a possible misuse. Mm-hmm. Possible use. And it's up to us to have the responsibility to be able to use it for the positive. And I think most people want that. It's really just a certain grouping that constantly intervenes.
But, you know, I mean, to some extent, it's I cannot judge it like from a technologically point, obviously, you know, just like out of this because I'm not familiar with the details. But I mean, to some extent, I always these super high tech things, you know, kind of give me the creeps. I mean, maybe at this point, because, you know, we've been because you need like huge structures, like governmental or like overseeing structures, in order to have them in place and to take care of them and all that. And so I would immediately, have the feeling that there can be, I mean, what you just mentioned, a lot of abuse or like lobbying going on, using into that direction or another one. And so I think it's maybe there are already like much simpler ways, like when you mentioned this thing, this greening, the two fields that we could see in Zimbabwe, you know, with the one doing this in a holistic way and the other in a sort of traditional way, mm-hmm. treating nature. And, you know, there's in Germany, there's a person called, he's in Austria, Sepp Holzer, who also follows like a permaculture approach. And it's really, I was there once years ago, and it was amazing. It was, I think, in October, and his garden, or it's like a 15 acres of basically like woodland, you know, and it was full of like there was like still like apples on the trees, and it was like it, you know, he had like wine grapes, like he'd planted the wine so that it was covering trees, basically. It was full of grapes. And so the local bio wine producing farmers came to him because it was like a horrible season with, like a lot of premature freezing. And they came to him and asked if they could pick the grapes. And so it was like, you could see that, you know, this treating the landscape in such manner was completely different from like the almost infertile field that you could see next door, you know, that was monoculture. And I think there's a lot of things that can be done in that area as well. I mean, with when it comes to this, basically you showed, I think it's this like some sort of solar radiation management, like geoengineering techniques. Is that what you said, like this weather manipulation with like producing rain in certain areas?
Yeah, that's to create ionization for cloud formation.
Yeah, but that would be done like by putting ionizing elements into the air or like through the river. You mentioned rivers. How would that work?
Well, you're using positive and negative potentials to create. But I mean, you already have the ions there, but it's to collect them so that they can form a nuclei to form a cloud. But it's what naturally occurs.
But it's
how it works in mm-hmm. nature. So it's basically just stimulating because you have water rivers in the sky. So you can have these iron masts such that these rivers in the sky will oftentimes pass over desert areas, and it won't rain over those areas. So you can have these iron masts there to have some rainfall in the areas, so that you don't have to wait just by the whim of whatever for that to occur. And
introduced? How do you produce the rain from this? Like what kind of element, what kind of technological installation would you have need to have to make that?
It's very basic. It's a very basic setup where they have an iron mast with like, and you just hold up the iron mast and you're sending certain either positive or negative potentials. So it's grabbing the humidity off from the coastline, and it's just causing cloud formation to occur, and you're causing a movement with placing the iron masts, you know, further inland. So you're drawing the cloud formation mm-hmm. further inland so that it can have rainfall. So for instance, Sergei Pulinets, who was doing this in Mexico, he was able to fill three dams using that, and also to help with forest fires, because that's another problem, you know, when we have forest fires and you don't have enough water to deal with that. This has been shown by Sergei Pulinets's work in Mexico to have applications for even putting out forest fires, which, I mean, forest fires have a natural use to them as well. When it's dangerous or it's out of control, you can help. decrease the amount of.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds interesting. I mean, we would really need to look into all these technological things much more in detail to understand them completely. At least I would need to do that. But, you know, I wanted to, because I at first I thought you meant it was done like with this, putting stuff into the air. And that, I think, is a problematic technology, because I once was confronted with I was in a 3-day seminar by the Academy of the Sciences here in Berlin, like a lot of big shot researchers in that field. And they made reference to David Keith from Harvard, who's this, I think he's sponsored also by Bill Gates. And they were like looking to for ways to, it was like in the context of global warming, that maybe you could put stuff into the air so that it would, the solar radiation wouldn't be so strong on Earth, but the problem, came up with all these problematic aspects that then the vaporization kind of changes, and you would need to put more and more in ever growing higher growing doses into the air in order to keep the same effect of solar radiation reflection. And it sounded like a giant technology illusion, what they were up to suggest. So it didn't sound like a
This technology with Sergey Polonets is super straightforward. And again, it's using natural processes. So it's not introducing anything new into the sky. It's really just giving us the ability to form cloud formations in these river channels in the sky so that we can decide where the rainfall occurs, and the river systems won't be tapped out because the river systems come from the ocean itself. It's going to replenish itself. As you have more vegetation inland, you can sustain that water so that it doesn't wash off and this sort of stuff. But yeah, there's a lot of natural, very simple natural things that we can do just in terms of returning to proper techniques like the herd grazing or even the agricultural practices. There's really bad agricultural practices now that strip the land of its richness. And that's why they're addicted now to all of these like fertilizers and all of this, which you might need a little bit of that, but not in the quantities that they're using, or all the pesticides and all of that too. You wouldn't need that if you were doing your agriculture, I think, in a better way. Actually, there's a documentary with Woody Harrelson, something about, I forgot the name of it, but it's really good. It goes over proper agricultural techniques and how we need to come back to that and not be so addicted to all of these chemicals that we're putting in for crop growth, which still are not very healthy crops anyway.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, once you start looking at things in detail, everything is becomes up to discussion, yeah.
Well, you guys are processing a lot of information, so.
Yeah, but we like that. The more information, the better your base of for real decision making. And we realize now, and even our good friend Martin Schwab, he's a professor of law at one of our universities here. Even he used to believe everything that the mainstream media told him. Even he says, I don't believe anything anymore. So we need all the information we can get in order to come to a real conclusion of what is really going on, because what we've been told is obviously, in 99% of the cases, blatant lies. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Another tour de force, but it's very, the outlook is very positive, the outlook you gave us. And so if you give us a chance to take a closer look, us and our viewers, of course, to take a closer look at these developments that you explained to us, mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that there are more people who are going to add on to this, who are going to give extra information that will lead us into an even better, more positive outlook. But it's
there's a lot of positive things going on in medicine too that has been kept out of mainstream medicine, but that also deals with the electromagnetic understanding of our body's relationship again to these processes. And it looks like a really, really promising stuff is coming out of this. So
excellent. I have to invite you again to explain that to us.
Or I know someone that might do a better job than me, who's much more prominent as a scientist.
Very good.
All right. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on our committee. Again, this is very enlightening and very promising, and we can end this year on a very optimistic note.
Yes, we have a lot of really good ideas right now, and people just, as you said, I think people are waking up. So yeah, we just have to be vigilant that what are the positive applications to this and what are the applications we should not have funding into, which, you know, the military industrial complex is doing a lot of the bad research right now in these promising fields.
Obviously. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Please say hi to Eric.
Okay, I will. Thank you. Bye.
And have a great new year.
You too. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you.